Welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iFormRx, and joining me today is Megan Supple and Peter Koval from Cone Health in Greensboro, North Carolina. And we're going to be talking about the GLP-1 receptor agonist liraglutide and its impact on cardiovascular events in patients with type 2 diabetes. The results of the LEADER study were recently released in June 2016 during the American Diabetes Association annual meeting and then subsequently published in the New England Journal of Medicine in July. Dr. Supple and Koval wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled Liraglutide, the new leader for second-line therapy in diabetes management. Megan, Pete, thanks for joining me today for the iFormRx podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Stuart, thanks for the opportunity to discuss this key trial.
So, Megan, if you had to briefly summarize in four sentences or less the study entitled Liraglutide and Cardiovascular Outcomes in Type 2 Diabetes to someone who hasn't read the paper, what would you say?
The LEADER trial evaluated liraglutide against placebo in close to 10,000 patients internationally with type 2 diabetes that were at high risk for cardiovascular disease. Patients were followed for about 3.5 to 5 years, and the authors were looking at a primary composite endpoint of death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal MI, and non-fatal stroke. Liraglutide showed a significant reduction in the primary endpoint with an absolute risk reduction of 1.9%. However, this was driven by a reduction in death from cardiovascular causes. These results are really exciting since liraglutide is the first GLP-1 receptor agonist to show cardiovascular benefit, and we may start to see a shift in our treatment of type 2 diabetic patients as a result.
So, Pete, what do you believe are the key strengths and weaknesses of this study, and are there any potential confounders present in the study that you believe may have impacted the results?
Let me start with confounders. I think there's two important ones, and they might be the presence of cardiovascular disease, and the second would be the additional glucose-modulating drug therapy in the comparative arms of the trial. So approximately 80% of the patients that were included in the LEADER trial had known cardiovascular disease, and the LEADER trial excluded other GLP agonists, which would be expected, and also excluded DPP-4 inhibitors, pramlintide, and also rapid-acting insulin. The minimal use of SGLT2 inhibitors is honestly something that would be expected as the first agent in the SGLT2 class wasn't even available to the U.S. market until approximately 1 year after the enrollment ended for the LEADER trial. So I'd suggest both the high prevalence of cardiovascular disease and the presence of significant background diabetes therapy make this data extremely hard to extrapolate as second-line drug therapy following metformin in the treatment of patients with type 2 diabetes, and specifically to younger patients with lower cardiovascular risk. One additional concern or confounder that's a challenge in looking at this data is interpreting and applying the information to specifically the North American cohort didn't show the same benefit as populations in Europe, Asia, or the rest of the world as a comparator group. So there's no obvious explanation for the differences in the location that's been suggested, but it's important to recognize there may be some potentially either genetic or regional differences to respond to these drug therapies. I think the biggest strength of the trial is the size of the trial and the fact it was multinational and a wide range of patients.
Megan and Pete, there have been several studies over the past 2 years that have examined the impact of the newer anti-diabetic drugs on cardiovascular outcomes. And most of these trials have demonstrated that these newer agents, and I hesitate to say new drugs, as most of them have been on the market now for about 5 years, but most of these newer agents have a neutral effect. They're neither harmful or helpful when compared to our more traditional treatment regimens. But two drugs, empagliflozin, as evidenced by outcomes from the EMPA-REG study, and now liraglutide, as evidenced by the LEADER study, have shown a positive impact not only by lowering cardiovascular event rates, but also mortality. So what do you see are the key similarities and differences between the EMPA-REG and LEADER studies? Do you find one of these studies more compelling than the other?
It may be a little easier to answer this question in two parts. Looking at similarities first between the two trials, Baseline A1C was slightly lower in EMPA-REG. It was 8.1 compared to 8.7 in the LEADER trial, and most patients had diabetes for at least 10 years in duration. The median follow-up period was also pretty similar between the two studies at about 3 to 4 years. There was also a similar reduction in absolute risk of 1.9% in LEADER compared to 1.6% in EMPA-REG. These similar results were driven by a reduction in death due to cardiovascular causes in both trials as well, although the trend towards lower event rates did occur much earlier in EMPA-REG. We started to see a divergence of lines there at about 3 months compared to 12 to 18 months for the LEADER trial. Due to the nature of SGLT2 inhibitors and their labeled contraindication, EMPA-REG also excluded patients with an eGFR less than 30, whereas the LEADER trial did not. While this may seem like a significant difference at first, patients with an eGFR less than 30 only actually made up 2 to 3% of the patient population in the LEADER trial. So this does seem like a fair assessment to say that the baseline populations were similar between trials in this regard, given the minimal data overall for patients falling into this subgroup.
Addressing the differences, in terms of the patient population, EMPA-REG was a study that looked at patients with known cardiovascular disease, whereas LEADER had about 20% of patients older than 60 years of age with cardiovascular risk factors. And I think that is important as we compare the groups. A secondary endpoint also showed a lower rate of hospitalization for heart failure, so it's possible that the benefit of empagliflozin may be linked more closely with some type of hemodynamic change. Specifically for heart failure, the diuretic effect of increased urination and decreasing then fluid volume, which may provide a difference in outcomes. The authors speculate there may be some type of modification of progression of atherosclerotic disease with liraglutide, and that may be something that needs further investigation on exactly how. It's really hard to state if one drug is better than the other based on these two trials, since we don't really have a head-to-head comparison, and the trials are slightly different.
So, Megan and Pete, I'd like to revisit a case we discussed a few months ago during a previous iFormRx podcast with Sarah Wettergreen and Jennifer Trujillo. I want you to imagine you have a 57-year-old woman who was admitted to the hospital 4 weeks ago with chest pain, and after a diagnostic workup, had two coronary artery stents placed. Now, prior to her hospitalization, the patient thought she was in relatively good health because she didn't require any medications. She admits, however, she was overweight and is overweight. At the time of admission, her blood glucose was significantly elevated and her A1C was 8.6%. The patient was given insulin during hospital stay and subsequently discharged on metformin titrated to 1,000 milligrams twice a day and instructed to follow up. She was also started on antihypertensive therapy, a high-potency statin, and dual antiplatelet therapy. You're seeing the patient for the first time today. Her A1C has improved to 8.2%, and the patient states that she's trying to lose weight. Given the results of the LEADER study, would you favor using liraglutide or some other GLP-1 agonist in this patient? Or would you prefer empagliflozin? Or perhaps a DPP-4 inhibitor? Or even basal insulin? How would you go about making a decision about which agent to recommend in a case like this?
When we're making decisions regarding initiation of new therapies, many factors do come into play. It's important to individualize therapy and take into consideration factors like patient preference, side effect profiles, insurance coverage, and even prescriber habits. Breaking down our medications here, we can split our options into two different groups, injectables and pills. If the patient is willing to give injections, insulin is always an option. However, for this particular patient, her A1C is only 8.2. I wouldn't probably consider insulin yet at this point. However, if her A1C were greater than 10 and she were symptomatic, I would definitely look more closely at initiating insulin to help control her symptoms more quickly and lower her A1C. I would consider initiating liraglutide if the patient is not needle phobic. Even for patients who may be hesitant to start a daily injection, the weight loss associated with liraglutide does tend to be a powerful motivator for many of our patients, especially for this patient in particular who admits to being overweight. With an A1C lowering potential of about 1.5%, liraglutide would definitely bring our patient to goal.
If I could address the oral therapy options, I think empagliflozin should move above DPP-4s in our algorithm for treatment, specifically because the benefits that we've seen in the EMPA-REG trial and realistically the lower efficacy of the DPP-4 class in general with respect to glycemic control. So an average A1C reduction appears slightly less. In our patient that we're studying here, we also have the benefit of weight loss. So again, empagliflozin would be a good option. I think insurance remains one of the biggest drivers in utilization of therapy. And would I switch from liraglutide to empagliflozin and change class based on insurance limitations is a wonderful question. I really think that individualization of therapy based on coverage and whether they're willing to do injection therapy is one of the main drivers in selecting between our two things we're discussing today, a GLP agonist or an SGLT2 inhibitor.
So I think we all agree that treatment regimens need to be individualized, but let me play devil's advocate. If cost wasn't an issue and there was no barriers due to insurance and the patient was willing to take either an oral or an injectable therapy, would you favor empagliflozin or liraglutide and why?
My vote in this case is for liraglutide. We see greater weight loss here, it's relatively well tolerated, and we can titrate the dose as needed to accommodate any GI issues that the patient may have. And now we have the cardiovascular benefit to support that.
And I'll take the other option. I'll take empagliflozin. Surprisingly, it has renal protective data in addition to the CV benefits we've seen in the EMPA-REG trial. So at this point, I'd pick empagliflozin as a second-line medicine to metformin in many patients, including the patient in this scenario.
Well, thank you both, Megan and Pete, for joining us today to discuss the LEADER study and the use of liraglutide in patients with type 2 diabetes at high risk for cardiovascular events. It's clear from your comments that you believe that liraglutide has a significant benefit in patients who are at high risk for cardiovascular events, but so does empagliflozin, and it's really difficult to know which of these two agents we should be using as second-line therapy in either patients who are on multiple background therapies or perhaps as the first add-on therapy in patients who are already on metformin. Well, tell us what you think. Should liraglutide be the first add-on therapy to metformin or perhaps the first injectable add-on therapy? Or should it be empagliflozin? What criteria do you use to pick one of these agents, one over the other? Or do you think it's simply too soon to favor any agent as a second-line therapy? Remember, only iPharmRx members can leave comments and access our growing list of resource pages. You can become a member of iPharmRx. It's free. Sign up today and be sure to sign in every time you visit. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iPharmRx, signing off.